Friday the 31st of January 2014. Seem to be becoming extremely conscious of various aspects of life that were out of reach previously, due, I think, to my getting older and the recent spate of deaths and close friends becoming ill. The other day, I observed a young, quite heavily pregnant woman in the botanical gardens. I had a very strong, almost tangible sense of the fetus she was carrying. The fact that this life, still only in utero, was the beginning of a unique life experience. I found it moving and wonderful, but also sad and upsetting. I think it was because I've become so aware of the individual trajectory of everyone I see, all on their particular pathway and all so insignificant within the larger scheme. The irony of birth, life, death, the exquisite experience of sentient life placed against the ultimate ending of that experience. Obviously, it's the fact of dying which reinforces the extraordinary, palpable immediacy of living. Now, listening in the studio, I lower myself into the sonorities as into a warm bath. It's such a sensational high, like a very deep massage for the soul. The idea that this will quite soon no longer be possible is, to put it mildly, alarming. I know this is simply the experience of getting older, and for me personally, further repercussions of Doreen's death. But it's so tempting in this context to change one's mode of operating, to somehow savour the process, to attempt to hold back the passing of the last portion of one's life, to postpone the approaching end. Of course, living in this way is not tenable or desirable. One must take one's gaze off the approaching finality and exist as one always did, as if one was oblivious to what lies ahead. Of course, until quite recently, I was oblivious. There's a difference between an oblivion inhabited naturally and one artificially constructed. Like being on an exposed climb, the moment you look down and think, what the fuck am I doing here, you are no longer able to make the next move with the same assurance as previously. Life's a block of chocolate. When you get down to the last piece, do you cut it into smaller and smaller portions in order to eke it out? Or do you retain your normal daily allowance and accept the unpalatable fact of no more chocolate? Saturday, 1st of March, 2014. It seems Kate Mead of Radio New Zealand is interested in a series of programmes for 2015, cooked up by Robert Hoskins and myself. The material will be based around the making of documents, with contextualising discussion and interviews between Robert and me. I'm really happy about this, especially if it can coincide with the Christchurch Art Gallery facilitating studio visits via Peter Vangione. Note, a thought for the radio programmes. When I left the university over 10 years ago, my main objective was to see what would happen if I let my working processes have their head and just grow or not by themselves, with no external impetus. It was similar to undertaking a prolonged expedition to a very isolated unknown location, one where I would be thrown totally upon my own resources and from which I could expect no rescue, a deliberate striking out into an almost totally unknown environment. The results have been extraordinary, both in objectives identified and gained and in costs, both financial and emotional. This model of an expedition is, I think, an apt one, except that it fails to convey the elusive creative dimension, the immaterial, ethereal factor of art making that makes it so much more difficult to sustain than any kind of physical endeavour. It's a journey into the world of the spirit via the imagination. No real substance is involved except sound, which itself is invisible and temporarily transient. I must think more about this metaphor and use it to ground the radio programmes at various points. Wednesday, the 2nd of April 2014. Just to note, I am more and more sensitized to the being alive sensation. It's become both a blessing and a curse. A blessing through the intense appreciation of being sentient, and a curse because I can grow enormously anxious about the impending cessation of that sentience. A silly little paradox that I didn't encounter in my younger days when I was ignorant of both categories of sensation. I do wonder sometimes if my protracted periods of exposure to the natural world and my intense pondering of the implications of this, both for work and life, has left me vulnerable to more than my share of anxiety as I approach the final period of my life. In a word, life's so glorious, so profoundly invigorating, I can't bear the idea that it'll soon end. As I say in the wind-up of the Hoskins interview, I find myself gliding into this totally new place, enormously full of light and wonderfully joyful.
Yes.
Saturday, the 12th of April, 2014. The Cresswells arrive next week. Then I shall reconfigure the studio and get back into studies. Background idea. Paradox. Two opposed polarities that are contrasted extremes of the one impulse. From my previously documented state, intense awareness of life allied with intense awareness of death. Joy and fear in the one breath. They can't be separated, no matter how much I would like to ignore one in favour of the other. Of course, this is encompassed by the understanding that there's nothing unusual in this experience. It's banal in its prosaic inevitability. Technically, this means bringing forth the essential oneness in seemingly contrasted materials, or put another way, beginning with neutral materials that are then transformed in opposing directions, sacred and profane, a dilemma that can't be resolved, despair shot through with intense joy. No words, but many categories of change along the continuum. Saturday, the 19th of April, 2014. Lyle and Catherine Cresswell have been staying for the last few days. He's in New Zealand for performances of a new song cycle with the NZSO. During his stay, he listened to a couple of works, Dirge and Shape, and we also listened together to his new CD, Landscapes of the Soul, featuring the piano concerto, the string quartet and orchestra concerto, and the string piece, Landscapes of the Soul. The piano concerto in particular seemed to prompt in me a new acceptance of pitch-based composition that wasn't functionally tonal. And so when I played him Shape, I removed the spoken material, leaving the work in its original, first-produced state. Both Lyle and myself agreed that the work sustained itself without the semantic data-carrying stuff. So over a year since the so-called final resolution of this work, I've changed my mind again and intend leaving it as a purely noise-based object. Note, it wasn't Lyle's opinion that changed my mind. It was the experience of listening to his work. His invention is highly original and yet follows strongly procedural methods. The sonorities are subjugated to the motivic evolution of the materials. This seems to offer the listener a sense of rational progression during the consecutive moments of the work and stops the sounds from evincing only first-order connections. Something has become clear, or at least seems to be at this present moment. Monday the 21st of April 2014, 11:56 p.m. In the light of my recent listening to Lyle's works and the subsequent re-evaluation of Shape, I think I realise what's been driving my weird symptoms over the last months. It's hard to put into words. I sense that I've come to a place in making work that's been waiting for me all my creative life. A place most composers experience as a starting point rather than a destination. Namely, that sounds are all that there is, and the work must be about them and nothing else. This requires a dispassionate pragmatism towards the task, clear-headed and uninvolved. Rationality is prime in this mode and should not be clouded by subjective feelings. Of course, the paradox lies in the fact that rationality alone, will produce merely a shopping list of sounds. The rationality needs therefore to be grafted upon deeply subjective motives springing from personal intuition. The expressive underground foundations upon which the superstructure of the work is built. Maybe now I might be able to proceed with noise alone in a way that will allow multi-level connections to occur. I was correct when I felt that any work, if it is to be coherent, needs to be propelled by a narrative of some kind. The old functionally tonal pitch system is such a thing. The abstract tonal expectations are, to all intents, a narrative, often complemented by contrasting motivic characterization. In shape, I got a little way towards this, via the putting together of contrasted sound gestures with their families of variants. But my focus was still too much upon the sonorous effect of the materials, and not enough upon the argument proffered by the various spectromorphologies. I need to work much more deeply and systematically on studies related to each core idea and wield the results more adroitly. The deeper I delve into the possible variants of an idea, the more fully the underlying subjective implications of that idea can be made extant. Detailed spectral and spatial potential needs to be apprehended fully before any larger strategic modelling is undertaken. Most of all, I have the feeling that I may be shaking off historical personal concerns and entering a more balanced environment. This is both exciting, as it ushers in the possibility of more coherent formal progress, and terrifying, as it requires the jettisoning of a lifetime's habit. Tuesday, the 22nd of April, 2014, further to yesterday's notes, analogy with painting. Relative sound amplitude, morphology, equates with the two-dimensional forms and shapes used. Spectral content equates with colours. Each medium employs certain techniques that spring from the transformative potential of the materials. These are relatively fixed in both cases. The starting ideas, however, are constrained only by the physical nature of the materials themselves. Up until now, I've been convinced that manipulating sound solely on the basis of their spectromorphology in a reduced manner can't produce coherent, large-scale structures that evince multi-level connections. However, I'm now going to attempt to do this by focusing fully on the character of each sound and producing sets of variants that spring naturally from the source itself. Then the job will be to organise these materials in such a way as to allow a multi-level narrative to occur. Thank you. Wednesday, the 30th of April 2014. Yet further ruminations regarding words or no words, particularly with regard to shape. A number of alternatives which could be applied to any work, music, painting, dance, whatever. A title printed on a programme or in the media, made known to the audience in any way except from within the work itself. In Lyle Creswell's case, Landscapes of the Soul for string orchestra. In my case, Shape for loud speakers. An alternative for us both could read Lyle Creswell, Work for string orchestra, John Cousins, Work for loud speakers. If you examine Lyle's program note for the string piece, see the CD cover, it suggests a relationship between landscape painting and his composition. He articulates the nature of the task undertaken by the painter and suggests a similar procedure in his own methodology. Note that he never mentions the last part of the title, namely the soul. He explains the landscape part, but leaves the soul bit entirely to the imagination of the listener. After all, what are landscapes of the soul? It's important to note that he doesn't present the work without context. He takes some trouble via the title and the program note to provide a push-off point for the imagination of the listener. He doesn't leave the work to act entirely on its own. Once the work begins, however, there's no further reference to the title. The sound world is left intact and absolute. In my case, I can do the same. That is, provide a title and program note to situate the oral experience of the work for the listener, or I can include within the sound world of the work semantic data that acts as a more prominent comparator, enforcing more keenly the necessity to somehow connect the title and or its related materials to the sound world. I think in both cases, the contextualization provided by the composers is a good idea, like providing a setting for a gemstone, some sort of frame. If the works were to be experienced totally out of the blue, with no preparation for the audience, I think they would still work, but they would be less user-friendly. The question for me, however, is what is the effect of including the contextualizing material within the sound world of the work, not simply as ideas outside of the work? Even although the spoken words fit a unique category in that sound world, data rather than simply sonority, is it appropriate to place them there, or should they be always banished to the printed word, to another medium, experienced usually before the work is heard? Because he's convinced that the sound world of his work is entirely capable of delivering an intact message to the listener, Lyle has no problem in leaving the frame as an ancillary adjunct, or, as in other works, providing even less of a help, simple generic titles such as Piano Concerto, for example. In my case, however, I'm not so certain that the sounds alone can support the entire work because of their noise-based spectrum. So I feel the presence of the program as semantic data within the work itself is necessary. When I listen to Shape without the words and then with the words, both with an identical printed program, I still can't help feeling that the second option is the most effective. Wednesday, the 21st of May, 2014. So, in Shape, for example, a substitute for the spoken words might be for one or more of the sound objects in the work to fully reveal its sign context, thus anchoring everything else as exhibiting some sort of connection with that sign. Already, in that work, there's a recognisable shower of rain, with subsequent water runoff. All of the other sounds are overtly acoustic, but are not contextualised to the point of full recognisability. In this respect, a comparison with a work like Rehab is apt. Here, the sounds of the workshop activity, with tools that are verbally described, allows the abstracting of those sounds to be connected to the overall context, the workshop, thus giving the work a sense of place similar to a tonic. Everything that happens in the work is related back to this context. Shape, on the other hand, lacks this quality. Thursday, the 22nd of May, 2014. What is the image thing produced by a Beethoven string quartet? It's the tonal structure produced by the wielding of the materials. This makes available to the listener a narrative that transcends the aesthetic impact of the materials per se. Here, the sounds infer a tonal thing that exists not beyond the sounds, as does the signal function of a noise sound, but within the sound world itself. In this way, tonal architecture remains abstract, but still subsumes the contributing elements. Note, the effect of thingness is reliant upon the tonal functionality of the materials. If this aspect is ignored or removed, then the sounds become simple aesthetic stimulators with no potential for transcending themselves. In my opinion, this applies to most of the atonal music for conventional acoustic instruments written in the 20th and 21st centuries. Tuesday, the 10th of June, 2014. Naming the Unnamed, an electroacoustic primer. I think this is the title of the next work. More Words. The final arrival of a thought from years ago when I was still teaching, namely a lecture presentation that metamorphoses into an artwork. Actually, many of my so-called lectures were in fact performance works. 12th of June, 2014. Draft of a long version of the program note for Naming the Unnameable. Daddy or Mummy, what's that? Every parent has experienced that question from a young, inquisitive child. It embodies the essence of our human curiosity. From the very beginning, we're applying our inbuilt requirement to identify and categorise. We have a problem with any object that doesn't present as a thing. Thingness is built into the way our perceptions make sense of the world. This quality marks the difference between a conglomerate of elements and a recognisable entity. In any human scenario, be it dealing with the dispassionate world of nature, or the subjective dramaturgy of our imaginations, our ability to apprehend something is commensurate with its being identifiable as something. Hence the irrational irritation produced when that childish question receives the maddening answer, a wigwam for a goose's bridle. Naming something with a nonsensical riddle places the entire equation in jeopardy and threatens us with a world we can't identify, an insane unhinged horror, a treacherous exposed unstable pinnacle from which we will surely plunge to our doom. This requirement applies as much to sound as to any other experience of the senses. The more recognisable a sound's signature, the more of a thing it becomes. We examine a sound's provenance involuntarily, looking for evidence of its source. So can there ever be a truly abstract sound, an absolute sonorous object? Or are all sounds heard as residue of an initiating event we can more or less identify? If this is the case, all sounds possess some degree of thingness. What is the image or thing produced, inferred or implied by the spectral morphology of a sound? This thing exists independently of the physical parameters of the sound. It's a self-contained resultant of the sound object. One responds to sounds in this way intuitively, and it is this fact that drives the technical manipulation of the sound for the composer. The response itself stays buried as an involuntary mechanism remaining unnamed. These are the two poles: objects simply as formal ciphers, as sensation stimulators, and objects that exploit sensory stimulation towards a further meaningful implication, where their first-order frisson is only a stage in their ultimate objective, namely, to attain thingness, and hence meaning. This sort of method or action is therefore ipso facto impossible to penetrate in any dispassionate manner. It can't be rationally apprehended. For it to exist at all, it must be left to the intuition, essentially unthought about. My job is to keep searching for the presence of image, thingness, meaning in the extant object, guided by the sense of rightness I've described many times in the past. This involves constant juggling of materials and alteration of method. All of these jugglings are intuitive. They must be, because if they're not, then a rationale can come about which quickly atrophies into a justification. Then the entire process is detached from its prime objective and becomes a pointless technical procedure, disconnected to its materials and unqualified by its intended outcome, which is to produce an image. Of course, no amount of intuitive juggling of materials and methods will succeed if the innate characteristics of the materials are inadequate for the intended purpose. Part of the intuitive choosing resides in the understanding that the choice itself is expressively potent. This is the point where the intuition is educated by aesthetic experience. The rational outside world speaking to the intuitive inside one via unthought about routine. So, the sign function of a sound is its image, the thing to which it refers. Hence, the relative proof of identity possessed by a sound is an important factor in how it establishes meaning. So, transformation in either direction along the continuum from object to thing, from abstraction to sign, is an important device in controlling the specificity of expression of a sound. Obviously, this involves the spectromorphology. This term was coined by New Zealand composer Dennis Smalley, and refers to the two interconnected parameters of a sound event, namely the frequency content or spectrum and the amplitude profile or morphology as they change over any durational period. This quasi-scientific terminology encourages a dispassionate examination of the physical properties of a sound and describes one aspect of its role for the listener, the other being the subjective responses evoked by the sound as it relates to their unique sonic experience. It's this latter aspect that produces such a range of potential expressive outcomes for any individual sound gesture. The spectromorphological profile of a sound is, nonetheless, an important descriptor of a sound's tendency towards being nameable. For example, a continuous stream of white noise, or a constant sine tone, with no discernible fluctuations of amplitude, will reach redundancy very early in its duration, because the lack of amplitude profile will not allow us any predicative conclusions regarding its provenance. In other words, we can't tell what kind of thing it might be or might have come from. As the spectromorphological profile varies, we're allowed more data towards a decision regarding the sound's implications. It becomes less of an object and more of an image, until eventually we recognize it as a thing. That is, it functions fully as a sign, pointing at its source. We are then no longer aware of the physical parameters constituting the sound. They are subsumed by the thing being pointed to. This is very similar to sound as speech, where the formal sonic aspect is simply a carrier of data, of information, of thoughts and concepts. The example of a situation where you're listening to a language being spoken that you don't understand, and suddenly being able to understand. Here you switch from hearing the spoken syllables as a sound object and hearing them as carriers of an image, the linguistic meaning, which transcends their role as a sound object. All sounds fit into this continuum, not only speech, because all sounds precipitate a tendency in the listener to read them as signs, their potential as a signal being controlled by their formal characteristics. If no thing can be apprehended by the listener, then only a pattern of unintegrated sounds will be heard, an experience that may well be pleasurable for a while, but one that can never convey deeper, more life-enhancing insights. Ironically, this is the objective to which most art aspires. Wednesday, the 2nd of July, 2014. Contemplating what sort of object should replace the spoken text in naming the unnameable. I know it needs to be a sound that has acoustic authenticity, untouched, at least seemingly, by any transformation. It needs a presence that makes it totally real. But it also needs to be unidentifiable, a sound made by an actual thing that doesn't reveal its source, just embodies it. The chiselling task seems to fit this, but I'm struggling with the risk of leaving it in its raw state. Once it is established in the work, then I can introduce transforms which eventually link it to the rest of the texture. Such an interesting dilemma. Saturday, the 5th of July, 2014. More on thingness. In the present piece, naming the unnameable, I need to present a central sound object that carries enough data to indicate it is or has been produced by a thing, but not enough data to identify exactly what that thing might be. Again, the science of archaeology comes to mind. The work is an environment within which the listener discovers an object that might be an artifact of some kind. The constitution of the object, the characteristics of its materials, must encourage the listener to search intuitively for what this might be. Questions must be posed. Is the object merely a product of natural processes, or is there evidence of human fabrication? If the latter is so, what role might the object have played in the larger human context? In the archaeological situation, the object may be taken back to the laboratory to undergo a battery of tests in an attempt to gain more information that might lead to a definitive conclusion. Electron microscope examination, various spectrometric tests, even destructive processing of samples of the object may occur. In the case of the sound work underway at present, I realise I have to process the sound object in my own sound laboratory in a similar way. These processes will result in audio materials that can then be presented in the work. Only one sound, the recording of the chiselling task, can be the central object. The rest of the texture may be viewed as either debris from the process itself or as analogous to the broader physical environment within which the central object resides. Thursday, the 10th of July, 2014. A little more on the present dilemma. I've been trying all sorts of options. The latest version, after various inclusions of the spoken text, excludes any overt spoken material which has been placed in the program booklet. The difference between versions with or without spoken material is very clear in this work. As soon as there is spoken stuff, the sound world reduces, because the listener hears it as an adjunct to the ideas and concepts communicated by the words. If there are no words, then the sounds alone must hold the attention, thus bringing them into a primary rather than secondary role. As the work has developed, I've included more and more material derived from the chiselling recordings. I realise this is the thing that needs to be hovering over the work all the time, even in its more transparent, less confronting passages. The insistence of the primary sound file stops the sections from becoming too episodic, because they all, either at first or eventually, even the one introduced by the simple sign tone, revert to the initial sound file. I realise I need to do much more work on this fact before the thing is completed. Note, the original chisel file conveys enormous energy. It's full of work force. Thus, the softer, more distant materials give relief from this frontal display. And again, the spatial zones are being used much more flexibly and more naturally. These decisions seem more and more to spring from the materials and the context they delineate. What's that? Wednesday, the 23rd of July, 2014. Final few comments on the unnameable. Eventually, a spoken phrase has found its way into the work, but not until the very last gesture. This occurred because I was having difficulty securing a convincing end to the work. So much of the latter part of the work evinces a vocal provenance. You can hear more and more attempts at speech. Thus the emergence of the final phrase, "What's that?" This also usefully connects with the program note. I really think the spatial aspects of this work are successful. Most of the materials are of relatively short duration and lend themselves to the cut and paste procedure, followed by a mixing in the air effect. Even in the contrasted, softer, more subdued sections, the thing insists on reappearing in various guises. It's all about that singular sound file, so that when the final question is finally articulated, there can be no doubt, I hope, that the that is in fact this insistent thing.